Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Love Foot Podcast, and today I'm really looking forward to this interview. Joining us is Mark Huberman. He is the president of the National Health Association, which is the oldest organization in the world supporting a whole foods plant-based vegan diet. He's also the editor of the Health Science magazine. Mark has adhered to a whole food plant-based vegan diet since birth in 1951. He credits his excellent health to the pioneering vision of his parents, Max and Ruth Huberman, who had the foresight to recognize the profound benefits of this lifestyle long before many others. And for 32 and a half years of that time, he ate a fully, or I think entirely raw diet of fruits and vegetables in that time. And looking forward to learn more about everything that he does. And I'm sure he's going to have a lot of great things to share with us. So, Mark, is there anything else you would like to say about yourself in an introduction? And I'd like to just welcome you today.
No, it's just a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to meet you.
So usually, Mark, when I have conversations with people, what I like to be able to point out for a lot of for the people that are listening is that most people don't start off on a healthy diet. You know, they on the kind of typical standard American diet. And we can talk about their story of how they ended up changing to a healthier plant-based vegan raw style diet. But I can't really do that with you, because you were brought up basically on probably a similar diet to what you eat today, I imagine, or something similar to that. And you've had the benefits of that all your life. So that makes you completely different to a lot of our guests. Have you ever met anyone else that was brought up on a...
I have not. I think I'm exhibit A. I really haven't, you know, and I've grown up in this health movement, in the American Natural Hygiene Society, which was the former name of the National Health Association. And that's kind of where, you know, the faithful before Colin Campbell coined the term whole food plant-based, we were the natural hygienists. I mean, there were some vegans around, but veganism really came around in like 1960. I think Jay Dinshaw kind of coined that term. There have been vegetarians around a long time. But those that were focused more on a comprehensive health system, the natural hygienists, that was the American Natural Hygiene Society that was founded in 1948. And the principal theorists were Dr. Herbert Shelton, who wrote Fasting Can Save Your Life, Health for the Millions, The Hygienic System, Dr. William Esser, Dr. Giancursio. These were the, you know, kind of the theorists of that health movement that really drew upon 18th and 19th century people that were looking comprehensively at health, like Russell Trawell and Isaac Jennings and Sylvester Graham and Bertrand Brenner and people from all over the world. So again, I growing up in this health movement from probably, I came to my first conference probably when I was about 10 years old in 1961, I think. I never met anybody like me. You're right about that. I've never met anybody that was raised from day one on the kind of the pristine Sheltonian diet of whole raw fruits and vegetables. That's the way I was raised, and that's the way I stuck it out through about 32 and a half years. And as you say, I did kind of graduate to steamed vegetables and baked potatoes and things like that when I was 32 and a half years old, mainly because I think having grown up in this health movement, and having been around the leading voices of Alan Goldhammer and Joel Fuhrman and Alec Burton and Keki Sidwa and William Esser and Stefan Essadi, none of these people thought that, while all of them thought that growing up and eating, having the lion's share of your diet being raw fruits and vegetables, that's truly the whole food, the pristine whole food diet, that it wasn't necessary to sustain health. And in addition, it's for many people proved difficult to sustain weight and satiety on that. That wasn't my issue. I mean, I've never been heavy. And even when I started eating cooked foods, it didn't really change my body weight. I've still been 120, 125 pounds since I was 18 years old. But for a lot of people, it's difficult to sustain. And probably the difference with me is that, again, I started this way. I didn't try to impose it on a physiology that had been raised a different way. And as you know, I'm sure that there's plenty of valuable foods in the whole food plant-based health movement, legumes that, you know, you're not going to eat unless you sprout, you can sprout soybeans and lentils and split peas, but you're not gonna eat them as they are. I guess you could sprout, soak them and sprout them, and for things, even things like kale and Swiss chard, there are things you can certainly eat raw, but boy, unless you massage them with some avocado and that, unless you steam them, they're not that tasty. And so again, 32 and a half years, I kind of felt was enough. I was doing it. I think I reached the conclusion I was doing it only because it's the only thing I knew, rather than I thought it was something necessary to sustain my health. And I kind of hoped, actually, when I started eating steamed vegetables and baked potatoes, that I'd put on 10 pounds, but that didn't happen either. I've been the same. My physiology is my physiology, and I guess that's not going to change very much. But I still, the lion's share of what I eat is still a raw food diet. I mean, I have oatmeal and fruit and things like that for breakfast. I have a pita pocket and a salad and that for lunch. And I have a big salad for dinner. And my only real cooked meal of the day usually is at night, a baked potato, a yam, some split pea soup or something like that. But I'm still mostly live foods. That's kind of my birthright. It's how I was raised, on whole fruits and vegetables. And that's still what I enjoy and love the most.
Can I ask you about your parents then? What's their story and how did they manage to find out about this?
Sure.
1950s or the 1940s, maybe even.
Sure. So like most people, my late great father used to say that most people don't worry about their health until after they've lost it. They have a health crisis that causes them, they're facing surgery, they're facing being a cripple, they're facing whatever they are the rest of their life. And, you know, maybe they'll be open to another way. Lots of people, unfortunately, that's not true. That, you know, they'll have a heart attack and they'll have a bypass, and then they'll just go back to drinking and eating fried foods, and people will smoke and they'll have lung cancer and they'll go back to smoking. But for some people, and I don't think any of us in this movement have ever figured out that secret sauce as to what is that thing that allows some people to just click.
Yeah.
And make that change. And if we could figure that out, if you and I could write the book, we'd be millionaires as to what causes people to do this. But fortunately, some do. They're open-minded people. And my parents were like those kind of people that had health problems. My father was a boxer and a hulk of a guy, an athlete and everything else. And when he was walking, I have an older brother who's 3 years older than me. And around 1950, he was walking down the street with my brother and collapsed with paralytic polio and was faced with being in, you know, one of those iron machine, you know, those iron lung machines or whatever it is. And that just wasn't acceptable to him. And it was acceptable. It was reality. But he happened to work for a guy who owned a furniture company. And he was a salesman. And this guy was an ardent vegetarian back in the late 40s and 50s. They politically were very aligned. They were very socialist, communist. That's where they were. So they had a lot of things in common. And he said to my dad, you know, he visited my dad. He says, Max, look, and my mother had some health problems too. She had some thyroid problems. She had some appendix problems. My older brother had bronchial asthma. So they were just kind of like a constellation of health problems. And this guy, Ben, said to my dad, Max, you know, I think there's a better way. Why don't you come to Cleveland, Ohio, which is about an hour away. And there's a lecture being given by Dr. Herbert Shelton and Dr. Gerald Benish, who were in Cleveland at the time. He said, just listen, see if it makes any sense to you. He and my mom went. They are those unique people that said, wow, you know, maybe this is a better way. And they got a juice machine. They got a fruit and vegetable or carrot juice machine. They got a slant board. They opened their windows to get fresh air for my brother. They got a humidifier for my brother. And they became vegetarians. I mean, this was like the first step. And they got better. My brother got better. My father got better. My mother still has her appendix. And they did well. And like for everybody else, it was a path and a journey. But the next chapter of this, and then they become members of the American Natural Hygiene Society, where again, there was an organization of doctors, you know, evangelists for this kind of health movement, saying, look, you know, this isn't just magic. There really is a health system. There really are basic principles. There really are laws of life that the body is made to heal if given conditions conducive to recovery. there's this remarkable thing called water fasting that can be a great benefit to giving you conditions, improving conditions conducive to recovery. These are all good things, and try it. So they, you know, would go to this kind of like, I think our conferences were like revival meetings for the faithful. They would all go, and, you know, they were all there. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of science supporting all of this at that time. But, you know, these doctors had the empirical observations that their patients got well, just like, you know, Sylvester Graham had his Graham houses during the cholera epidemics in New York in the 1800s, and everybody else is dying and his people got well, being a vegetarian diet and fresh air and all that. So it kind of made sense to them. So along comes, make a short story long, along comes Mark Huberman in 1951. My parents are they're zealous about this business right then. And so two things that they did that were quite controversial, that were principles of the American Natural Hygiene Society, the natural hygiene movement, the Sheltonian health program. They didn't give me the vaccinations that everybody else did. They didn't want to do that. They thought that was just putting poisons and toxins into your body. And they didn't want to give me cow's milk. Mother's milk was the way it was supposed to be, and that's the way she went. Well, these were pretty, even then, were pretty controversial ideas. Family members were so upset over the approach my parents were taking, not giving them dairy, not giving them milk, and not vaccinating them, they called the health department on my parents for neglecting their children. I mean, their own family, sisters and brothers. My mother was always a more of an emotional sort of person. She's trying to nurse me. She gets very emotional, at least as I understand it. Her milk spoiled as she's trying to nurse me. I was born this happy 8 pound, 5 ounce, beautiful little happy-go-lucky kid. 6 months later, I'm 6 pounds, 5 ounces. I couldn't keep any food down. I was projectile vomiting. I was just a pack of bones. They took me to Dr. Benish in Cleveland, who happened to be practicing in Cleveland at the time. And they said, look, you know, Ruth, two things. One is that your milk is no good. You got to try. This is the only non-vegan thing that probably ever happened in my life, is for a period of time, till you get your emotions under control, find somebody else to hold me, somebody calm, so that I'll relax. When you relax, I'll relax. When the person holding me relax, my food will stay down. Introduce a little vegetable juices, use a little soy milk, and try a little raw goat's milk. A little less problematic on the body. Short story long again. I got through. I survived. I started putting on weight again. I got back to my diet. Because I survived, I guess, as best as I look at it, my parents thought that if I survived, the Sheltonian diet was ideal. So even though they weren't even vegans in 1950, they thought it was right for me. And so they raised me on raw fruits and vegetables, nuts and dates and seeds. And that's the way I stayed, even though they didn't. They were vegan. My mother made homemade butter. My mother made homemade ice cream. My mother was a great vegetarian cook. They were vegetarians. They weren't vegans. But it was a path. And over the years, probably by the time I became a junior or so in high school, they became vegan. They became more whole food, plant-based. And the rest, as they say, is history. They were like most people. It's a journey to this lifestyle. Very few people change overnight. Some people do, but most don't. It's a path. And what they had going for them and what I had going for me is that science kind of caught up. So it wasn't just a belief and a faith that this Sheltonian diet was somehow some magical thing. But, you know, T. Colin Campbell writes the China study. Dean Ornish is doing his studies. Caldwell Esselstyn's doing his studies. Joel Fuhrman and Alan Goldhammer, these people, scientists, they're documenting scientifically that what these old guys saw empirically worked, that water fasting really does have an efficacy. The body really can cleanse and heal and repair itself. So science sort of started validating the foundation of my life. And for me, that probably personally was the most rewarding thing. When I went through grade school, being this oddball of taking my apples and cashews and raisins to lunch every day and everybody else eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and pizza, sloppy joe. It never bothered me. I did what I did. And you know, somehow I withstood the peer pressure and people saying I eat rabbit food or whatever it is. But I was always a pretty happy-go-lucky kid. My late great father always said that, you know, people often pick on you if you allow yourself to be picked on. If they think it's going to get to you, they'll be, people can be merciless. For me, that was never the case. I knew what I did. I knew what I liked. And I was a pretty social kind of guy. I had plenty of friends, plenty of neighbors. I played sports. I played ping pong. I was in theater. So I was oddball, maybe only in what I ate, but not in what I was in the rest of life. So for me, it was really never willpower. It was just, this is what I, just what I did. But to this day, I kind of back to the point is that I've still never had a piece of pizza. I've still never had a cone of ice cream. I've never had any kind of dairy. I've been around cheese, but even vegan cheeses, I'm not a fan of. It's just not tastes that appeal to me. I don't drink wine. I don't drink alcohol. I didn't do drugs. I didn't do marijuana. And I don't to this day. They're not whole foods. And they're not something that just ever appealed to me. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you know, I'm going to be 71 years old, June 26th. I don't profess to be that I'm going to live to be 120 like Methuselah. I don't claim to be perfect health, but I do pretty good. I think I go to a lot of my high school reunions. We had our 50th reunion 2 years ago, our 50th high school reunion. And a lot of my high school people are dead. And a lot of them look like my parents or my grandparents because life hasn't been too kind to them. That has not been the case with me. And I think I continue to make choices every day about what I eat, how much rest I get, how much sleep I get, how much exercise I do, how much, you know, I probably don't rest as much as I need to, but that's because I do a lot of things. I'm a very busy guy, but I think I make conscious choices every day as to how I think at its core, the blessing of growing up like I did and continuing to live like I did, is that I think you can control your own health destiny to a tremendous degree. I may develop a brain tumor tomorrow, but I don't think so. I think everything I've learned about, you know, the toxins that you put into your body and the lifestyle choices you make, you really can in this era of COVID, I really am a firm believer that you build your immunity. I've been building my immunity my whole life. I had COVID, at least I had tested positive for COVID in December, but I didn't have the symptoms. I certainly didn't wind up in the hospital and I tested negative, you know, 10 days later. So thank you very much. And that's the way I think it's supposed to work. I think you build your immunity, you don't buy your immunity. And so I'm incredibly blessed with the foundation that I was given, but I'm taking that foundation and I'm continuing to secure it and build on it every day through, you know, the whole plant food diet lifestyle that I follow.
And I'm curious, I've got a lot of questions and I'm kind of interested in back then, you know, the contrast now, it's so interesting because you're mentioning they didn't have evidence back then. There was just kind of ideas and theories and they were seen.
It was a philosophy. You know, I mean, they claimed science supported it, but it was mostly, you didn't have studies documenting it.
And I'm interested in what that movement really was, the natural hygiene movement, the hygienist movement. Like, how did that look at the time? Was this, because you mentioned, so there was lectures going on and there was a conference. Was that mostly how the information was getting out there? Was it people speaking and teaching? And
correct. It was before the internet, certainly way before the internet. So people wrote books. Herbert Shelton wrote, you know, The Hygienic System in the 1930s. He wrote Health for the Millions, Fasting Can Save Your Life, Natural Hygiene, The Pristine Way of Life. William Esser wrote books. Alec Burton wrote books. Keke Sidwell wrote books. So you had that, and our conferences, our annual conferences, which we've been doing since 1949, is where the faithful gathered. And there, and then along the way, because this was the only game in town, that's where T. Colin Campbell delivered his first lectures, and Neil Bernard delivered his first lectures, and Caldwell Esselstyn, you know, that they made, or Michael Clapper, that's where they made their early appearances, because we were the forum where these people could speak, and they were pretty inspiring people. And I suppose the other aspect of the landscape of the movement, where the movement was in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, is that these leaders, most of these leaders of our health movement in the United States and a couple abroad, Keki Sidwa in the UK, Alec Burton in Sydney, Australia, these people had health clinics, yeah, health facilities. And people would go there mainly for water fasting, because they, you know, that's what they did to regain your health. But then once you regain your health, you learn to live on a whole food plant-based diet, which was mainly a vegan vegetarian diet without salt, without oil, without sugar, without preservatives. That's the way you live. So people that wanted to learn about this lifestyle wasn't just listening to a lecture. You could go to Dr. Shelton's health school that operated for more than 50 years. Dr. Esser's ranch in Lake Worth, Florida, it's the same. Alec Burton's in his Hygieia Health Center in Sydney. Shalimar in the UK. Bob Gross had a facility in Rhinebeck, New York, the Pauling Health Manor. Ralph Sinquet had one in Texas, in Buda, Texas. And then, you know, a lot of them have fallen by the wayside because it took a unique kind of individual to operate these things. You were always a little bit outside the law, you know, was putting people on water fasting as a chiropractor or as a naturopath or as a medical doctor was a little, and I'm a lawyer. So I actually ended up representing these people when, you know, people could die in the hospital every day or have a bad outcome in the hospital every day. And that's just the way it is. God forbid you die or have a health problem at a fasting clinic or a hygiene clinic, then you're in the clutches of the law. And that's where I came in as a lawyer, helping defend these people to do that. Today, probably the premier facilities for getting this kind of health care is the True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California. Dr. Alan Goldhammer operates. He was a protege and a disciple of Dr. Burton. And Dr. Benish, there's a guy by the name of Nathan Gershfeld, who's kind of a disciple of Dr. Goldhammer. He operates a facility. There's a Dr. Gracie Ewan, who is a student of Dr. Scott, who operates one here in Ohio. So there aren't a lot. There's one in Puerto Rico, a Dr. Asa Frey, who also was at the True North Health Center under Dr. Goldhammer. So there aren't many. But that was the landscape then, and that's the landscape today. So people lectured. You came to these conferences, you learned, you read their pamphlets, you read their articles, you listened to their lectures, you bought cassette tapes, you bought reel-to-reel tapes in those days, and then cassette tapes, and then CDs, and then DVDs, and now you stream it. And that's what we do for our conferences. So like we have our 2022 NHA conference coming up June 24th to the 26th in Cleveland. But for people like you in the UK, and you know, now that you could travel again in the post-COVID world, it's still expensive to go. But we offer a virtual option where you can live stream the event. I think it's $97. You can sign up on our website, you can live stream the whole thing, and then get access to the replays for the next for a year, I think, after that. So that's, again, that's kind of how you learned it. And of course, the internet. You know, you can Google Joel Furman and you'll find 50 great lectures by Joel Furman. And the NHA, we have our own website where we archive health lectures and things like that. So that's kind of how information gets disseminated today.
Excellent. I want to speak to you. So many things I want to speak to you about from all this, but going back to you caught my attention with the legal thing. And I studied law. I never became a lawyer, but I did study the subject. But I've always been curious about what are the laws there surrounding things like water fasting and things, because I know there are laws about obviously restrictions on you can't practice medicine without a license and so on. And then the question would be, okay, where's the borderlines of that? And I feel like I see people that are, you know, wanting to help people with their health, and they start to recommend things and they start to do things. And I'm thinking, I feel like they're on the borderline of trying to act like a doctor here, you know, and I see that sometimes, whether it's well-intentioned or not. And then with the water fasting clinics, as you're saying, I've always been curious as to what is the legal.
Sure. Well, I can speak to the United States. So in the United States, and similar around the country, if you undertake the care of a patient for a fee and you call yourself a doctor, you're practicing medicine. And if you're practicing medicine, you better have a license. You better be licensed and legally licensed, have a bona fide license and a bona fide education in the state or province where you're practicing. That's number one. Number two, you got to be practicing within the scope of that license. So in the case of chiropractors, and most of the pioneers of this health movement, of the natural hygiene movement, like Dr. Shelton, like Dr. Esser, they were either chiropractors or naturopaths. And those are more limited scope licenses. And the reason I think they pursued it is they didn't believe in the pharmacology and didn't want to get brainwashed, and they didn't believe in the medical model, the allopathic model, and it was cheaper and shorter to go to school, so they had that license. So here in the United States, there are two chiropractic naturopaths are only licensed in a handful of states, probably 5-6, some like California, Washington, Arizona, a few others. Chiropractors are licensed in almost every state. But there's kind of a scope of license varies. They're called what they call some states, you're the straights, and others, you're the mixers. The straights are, under their license, your license is limited to the manipulation of the spine, subluxation of the spine. That's what chiropractors can do. In mixer states, you can do much more. You can prescribe nutrition. You can do blood work. You can give nutritional counseling. Those are the mixer states. So most of the chiropractors that would have open, you know, natural hygiene or water fasting clinics would want to be in the mixer states where the license is a little broader. And then it kind of goes back a little bit to where you went to school. What was the scope of your education? So at National Chiropractic College, Western States, and some of those, Dr. Scott, Dr. Goldhammer, some of these people made a point to lecture at those colleges so that you could, if you ever got sued as to whether you were operating within the scope of your license, you could say, oh no, as part of my chiropractic education, we actually studied water fasting and the benefits of water fasting. We studied the benefits of a plant-based diet. So I think we've been strategic in seeing that. Dr. Scott always lectured at his alma mater of National Chiropractic College. Alan Goldhammer does the same. So Alan Goldhammer lectures at Bastyr University, which is one of the premier naturopathic colleges. Dr. Furman does the same at the one in San Diego. So that's the medical legal link. That's kind of the minimum. All that being said, each state has its own regulatory board. And if they want to make it difficult for you, they can make it difficult for you. So you try to be careful. I think one of the things that, as a lawyer, when I became a lawyer in the late 70s and we were advising these doctors as to how to practice, and it's still what I advise them to today, is practice defensively. Be careful. Screen the patients you got. Make sure that you're not taking somebody with a gallbladder problem that's got mental health issues. Because if they, you know, attempt suicide or they have an episode and they wind up in the hospital, they're saying, well, what the hell were you as a chiropractor doing treating someone with paranoid schizophrenia?
Right.
And if God forbid that somebody commits suicide, and that happened to Dr. Scott. So I remember back a case in the 70s where Dr. Scott was fasting a guy who had, I don't remember what his specific condition was, but he was paranoid schizophrenic, undertook his water fast, had a successful fast, broke his fast, and just kind of wandered out of the facility one day, went to Lake Erie, which is near Cleveland, walked into the water and drowned himself. His father happened to be a police detective from New York who didn't buy this whole way of living. And it's a very litigious society, and they sued. And Dr. Scott, you know, he had malpractice insurance at the time. They settled the case, but it was difficult. So the other advice that I give people is screen your patients. And I think most of them do that carefully. And second is to be very careful. Do blood work, you know, do so that you're scientifically monitoring. Keep careful notes of the daily progress. See your patients every day. One of the problems at Dr. Shelton's health school in back in the day is that, you know, they'd see the patients every couple of days. They just had faith the body would be fine. Well, it's fine except when it's not fine. And then, you know, what is the professional standard of care to which you're going to be held? There are minimum standards of care.
Sure.
Complete case history, daily monitoring, careful notes, case notes, things like that. So most of the doctors today do that. Back in the day, life was different. The regulation wasn't as tight as it is today. But that's always been my advice. And so, and today, you know, Dr. Goldhammer's True North Health Center, he not only has chiropractors and naturopaths on staff, but he's got MDs on staff. He has three MDs that obviously have a bigger toolkit. Somebody's in a crisis and needs a hormone or some medication or some antibiotic to get through a crisis. He can do that. If they need to be admitted to the hospital, they have admitting privileges. That's practicing, in my book, practicing defensively, safely, appropriately, legally. And I think that's a sound thing to do.
And it's just that I guess I'm curious as to why it seems like True North, for example, stayed had been around for a long time and been quite successful. And why would there not be way more of these? Why haven't centers like that proliferated around the U.S.?
Tough to make a living, tough right. legal climate in which to do it. Again, Dr. Goldhammer, like everybody else, started small. And he's grown, and they've developed a research component and a foundation that supports the program. And, you know, he's just, you know, it takes, why does Elon Musk, you know, be successful in his company and the guy that created the Edsel not? I mean, it's unique individuals. Dr. Scott once said, it really does take a unique individual to run a health clinic just because of
right.
demands and the patients. And most of them, by the way, when they've started, they've been fortunate enough to have a spouse as a partner. So Alan Goldhammer had Jennifer Morano, his wife, and Bob Gross had Joy Gross, and Alec Burton and Nejla Burton. And, you know, they all had that going for them, and that always helped till they get bigger. But, you know, again, you know, what did Michael Greger, the legendary Michael Greger, says about why it's so tough to make a living in even the lifestyle medicine space. There's lots of lifestyle medicine physicians that try to see patients that want lifestyle medicine. They have great difficulty making a living because insurance doesn't pay you to talk to somebody. They pay you to do something, do a procedure, do a colonoscopy right. procedure. As Michael Greger says, there's no broccoli lobby. Yeah, it's just kind of the way the world works. So it's a tough way to make a living, but thank God we got people that are willing to go out on a limb like that and let their dedication be their driver to getting this good word out. You know, yeah. A lot of the people, like Michael Greger, is an author and a lecturer. He's not he doesn't see patients. Sure. Caldwell Esselstyn is the same. He runs little clinics, but, you know, his career as a physician at the Cleveland Clinic, his lifestyle medicine career is after that career. And fortunately, he's financially secure and able to do it, but not a lot of these guys. I just interviewed a Dr. Will Bolsiewicz, who wrote a book called The Gut Doctor, Gut Health. Great guy. And he's going to be the feature interview in the next issue of the magazine. He just, you know, he just left his gastrointestinal practice because he's going to try to make it doing lectures and seminars and courses and things like that, because what he wants to do. Whether he'll be able to do it financially is another matter.
Yeah, so that, I mean, essentially that is one of the main one of the main issues, I suppose, is that when it comes to getting out health information and health ideas, firstly, you're having to give a message to people that a lot of people don't really want to hear, in a sense. Like, a lot of people don't want to hear about changing their diet. They don't necessarily want to hear about removing certain things from their diet. And at the same time, people would much rather try and buy health in a pill, a packet, a lotion, a procedure, an alternative medicine. And so, you know, there's lots of temptation, obviously, for people to go towards that or make money that way. And yeah, the kind of lifestyle approaches me.
Yeah, my parents owned a mom and pop health food store. They were pioneer health food store people in the 1950s.
Right.
I grew up through every health craze there was, of lecithin and B12 and gluten-free and gluten. Actually, you want gluten. You don't want gluten. You want lecithin. You want, because everybody does like it quick. You know, and to this day, you know, you pick up any, I think that's, we publish Health Science Magazine. What I'm so proud of Health Science Magazine is, unlike just about any other health magazine you pick up, they're mostly advertisements for the latest food or super pill or super potion. Health Science has no advertising in it, just articles on health. I mean, it's kind of what we do, because we don't sell anything but information and education. But again, it's not a, most magazines are able to keep printing even with the skyrocketing costs of printing, because of advertising. You know, they'll sell you spirulina, or they'll sell you the latest protein supplement, or they'll sell you CBD is all the rage. You know, all the CBDs will solve all your problems right now. Hemp for all, hemp for life. Spirulina was back in blue green algae, when Alan Goldhammer called pond scum. That was the rage, all the rage for a while. And then every once in a while, there's a Polynesian juice, noni juice, or some other elixir.
Yeah.
The history of America. We want something quick and something cheap, rather than making the hard choices.
It's really funny you're talking about the blue-green algae. I remember we run an event in the UK, and we used to rent this venue that had a lake on it. And there were signs up saying, you know, danger, or like warning, there is blue green algae in this lake. It's funny, there's like a health product, but there's actually signs saying, you know, avoid it, don't go near it, when it's actually,
you know, it's kind of funny. And people, it's just funny again how the world works, but people find a way to make money out of everything. You know, when there was a byproduct of the aluminum industry was fluoride, this is the great way to improve your teeth and do your drinking water, and you know, the byproducts of everything are so pond scum, you know, the algae plumes that are destroying and suffocating the Great Lakes. All of a sudden, there's some magical nutritional component here that we all need to do, or it's acai juice, or it's everything except what T. Colin Campbell calls the whole. That's always been here, whole fruits and vegetables, unadulterated in their natural state. That's the way God put them here. And we keep looking for something more magical. But
yeah, so
much simpler than that.
I guess I want to talk about some of the figures in the movement going back. So Herbert Shelton, obviously, you bring up. And did you meet him? Did you see him speak?
You know, one of the great privileges of my life, I've met just about everybody. I even as a kid. So these were, you know, my parents' generation. So I met them. And then as I got older and became a leader in the movement, I was a vehicle for these people getting on the platform to speak at our conferences. So I met Dr. Shelton. And when I was 10 years old, I went to the first conference of the American Natural Hygiene Society in Chicago. I met the Dr. Shelton and Dr. Esser, and all these guys were there that came every year. So I met him. And then in the 1970s, I wanted to experience a water fast. So I also wanted to see Dr. Shelton's health school in San Antonio. So I went down to San Antonio and I met Dr. Shelton. By that time, he was much older and had suffered Parkinson's disease. But I met him. And one of the privileges of my life is in the first issue of Health Science Magazine, which I'll show you, which I invented back in 1978, when I became the youngest president of the American Natural Hygiene Society, 1977, I created this. I looked a little different in those days. but I interviewed Dr. Shelton for the first issue of the magazine. And it was really one of the privileges of my life, interviewing Dr. Shelton. And by the way, all these magazines, when people join the American Natural Hygiene Society or the National Health Association, they go onto our website, you register at healthscience.org, and for the $35 if you live in the US or $55 a year if you live outside the US, you get access to all those back issues for nothing. You just download them for free. And the interview with Dr. Shelton, I always get a kick out of it because I remember the first question I asked him, I could probably do it by heart, but I said to him, simple biographical question, when and where were you born? And Dr. Shelton said, I was born in the early morning of October 6, 1895 in a sharecropper's cabin near the little town of Wiley, Collin County, Texas. My father told me I was born during a storm. I've been in a storm most of my life. And he was treated by the medics. He was arrested. He was everything else, but a great man. And so I did meet him. I went to Dr. Esser's health ranch. Dr. Esser lived into his 90s. So I do Dr. Esser, you know, well into his great years. And there aren't many that I have not met. I met Dr. Curcio, who was one of our founders. And so that's, again, and then in my adult life of being president of the National Health Association and a leader of this organization, I've interviewed just about everybody who's anybody. So I know personally Michael Greger and Michael Clapper, and I just interviewed Dean Ornish. That's a real personal privilege of mine. But, you know, I think maybe we're getting at some of the principles that were around then that aren't so loud, like food combining. I don't know if you're probably familiar with Food Combining Made Easy was one of the books Dr. Shelton wrote and made famous. And the theory was that there was an alkaline and acid balance that you needed to maintain in your gut, and that you shouldn't combine certain foods or they kind of putrefy in your system. They wouldn't digest right. So there was this whole, and you probably can see them if you Google them, you'll see these elaborate charts about how you don't mix peanuts and potatoes and melon should be eaten alone and all these kind of principles. And they were quite popular, and people lived religiously by these principles. I grew up that way thinking, and I think to this day, I think if somebody handed me some peanuts and a baked potato, I think I don't think I could eat it. I just don't think I would. But as science has shown, there's really not science, at least in the opinion of doctor. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, but Dr. Furman and all these people that I respect a lot says science has not validated what these people, this kind of system and observations these people had. And I think the better thinking is the reason that it had some validity, or at least seemed to have some efficacy for people, is that when people observe food combining principles, they tend to eat less. They were eating less, and right. So it was easier on their system. They didn't overeat, and that's just kind of the way it was. And so maybe there was some validity, but the science of it, has not been supported, and it's not bothered. The Irish diagnosis was another tool that a lot of these use. They gaze into your eyes and they say, well, you know, I can, I guess they knew what they were looking for. They'd say, you know, I can see you have a problem with salt, or you're diabetic, or you're a pre-diabetic, or whatever it is. And again, getting people to stay away from salt and sugar and some of these things was probably a good idea. And also, it was suggested to me by some of these early pioneers that these people were just intuitive. Yeah. Whether they were actually seeing something in your eyes, they just knew human physiology. They knew they had seen so many patients in different states. They could look at Mark Huberman and say, Mark, look, you're toxic right now. You need to. And they just knew. Yeah. But in terms of the science of Irish diagnosis as a science, science hasn't established it. Probably the other big thing two other things that were kind of popular earlier in the day was colonics. There was this theory that if you did colonic irrigations, you could cleanse your gut and get all the toxins out. And science has not established that. In fact, it's kind of the better thinking today is it's actually more injurious to your health to do that on a repeated basis. And then nutritionally, there was the belief that a whole food Sheltonian diet of raw fruits and vegetables, nuts, dates, and seeds was all you needed. And if you just did that, you'd be fine. Today, there is a general consensus in our movement that if you're following a plant-based vegan diet, you probably need to supplement for B12. Why that is, you know, I think the older thinking was that you could synthesize B12 in your gut in days past. Maybe if you were like, I grew up in my father's organic garden, to this day in my organic garden, and I pick my strawberries and I don't wash them, and I probably got the microorganisms, and that's where I got my B12 from there. But, you know, we're so sanitized these days that we don't. So the better thinking is you should at least test your B12 level. Right. And probably for vegans, probably good to supplement. I do. I've tested. I've been low at times. I've supplemented. I take a sublingual B12, vegan based, and I maintain. Other people say you should test for D3. That's a little more controversial. But, you know, if you don't live in a sunshine environment, and should test, and if you're a little low, D3. Some, Dr. Furman and some others, say you should check your omega-3 level, your DHA levels. And if they're low, there's less agreement about what the standards for that are. But beyond that, I think those are the biggest changes that I've observed in the natural hygiene movement to today, that, you know, food combining really doesn't have a science behind it, that a raw food diet probably isn't necessary to sustain health, and you should test for at least a couple of supplements and see how you're doing. Other than that, the science, the program is pretty unchanged.
You mentioned some of the different conferences and the things that were going on. And I'm curious as to, did they generally agree on things, or was there still a lot of debate then as to what was the sort of ideal diet, or
I think
whether they generally should be vegan or not?
I always said, you know, I mean, doctors, my, again, long observation of this movement, doctors often have egos, and that ego can get in the way of their professionalism. They know I'm, and they can be professionally sensitive about those sort of things. But it has been always my observation as being a leader of this movement for the last 40 some years, they agree on 95% of what they do. And if one says, if Dr. Esselstyn says you shouldn't have any nuts if you have any heart problems, and a Dr. Furman and Dr. Greger and these other people say, no, actually just the opposite. You should, you really need healthy fats, but, you know, not too many. Some say you should have a little more dried fruits, but these are, to me, minuscule differences. They all agree that you want live foods in your diet. They all agree you shouldn't have processed foods. They all agree you shouldn't have white sugar and white flour. They all agree today that you should be salt, oil, and sugar free. You know, sugar, Dr. McDougall will say, you should have a little bit of salt. We're made to have a little bit of salt, but a little bit of salt. Others will say, you know, maple syrup and date syrup and things like that aren't so bad. But these are minuscule differences. They don't diminish the broad consensus of a whole plant food diet that you should be pursuing, and that you shouldn't, you know, the diet without additives. You should be getting adequate rest and sleep and pure water and fresh air, and organic, or organic where you can. Those broad consensus, people love to seize on differences, and it drives me nuts actually sometimes when I see people do that, because I think they do it almost to show that I've got it exactly right, and you're not quite exactly right.
So I was curious as to what exactly was your diet in the first 32 years as a child, as a teenager? What did it actually look like?
And amazingly, it was the same every single day. So I woke up, I was a patient of Dr. Benish. So Dr. Benish was always one who believed in that having orange juice in the morning with ground up almonds and sunflower seeds, you know, get fortified. This is before the era of smoothies, but that's what he thought was a good thing to do. So I had fruit for the morning, orange juice with ground up nuts and things like that. And it helped sustain me. If you just ate melon for breakfast, I don't know about you, but I know for me, if I just had melon for breakfast or just fruit without some oatmeal, without some nuts, I'd be hungry. It just wouldn't sustain me. So that's what I did. I had nut butters. When I would go to school for lunch, my lunches were, I take apples with some cashew butter in the middle, some celery sticks, some tomato sticks. We had trail mix before there was trail mix. I had cashews and raisins and dried apricots, things like that. That was my lunch. I'd have maybe a little glass of orange juice that I'd take with me when everybody else had their glass of milk. That was my lunch every day. And when I had dinner, was a big salad every day. A big salad. I mean, a big salad was not like, you know, a little salad like most people have. Mine was a big salad with avocado. Avocado was probably my biggest thing. And it is to this day that if I didn't grow up with avocado, I never would have made it. Because avocado was gave me that fat and that satisfaction. And that's what I did with my salads. And that the other thing that I did back then that I evolved to was oil. Oil wasn't such there wasn't so much known about oil as being, you know, just a foodless food, denatured food, just, and it could have long-term consequences for you. So oil was kind of a dressing that I used, crude old-fashioned safflower and sunflower oil and olive oil. So I used that as a dressing. But as I got older, I realized, again, there's no nutritional value in this whatsoever. It's just pure fat. And so when I was probably 18 years old, I stopped doing that. And the only time I would ever use a little bit of oil is if I was out at a restaurant and I had a salad and the salads were just, you know, pretty tasteless iceberg lettuce and things like that. I'd say, well, you have a little olive oil. I could just put a little olive oil on it and all that. But I don't even do that anymore. I tend to take my own avocado or I take a little bit of tahini dressing in my pocket. And that's what I do to this day. But so that's 32 and a half years. And amazingly, I look forward to it every day. I think one other secret to how I was able to do, two other secrets as to how I was able to do this, is that my parents, I think I told you, had a mom and pop health food store.
Yeah.
But where they were really unique, where they were also pioneers, they were pioneers in the organic food movement. So my father was involved in an organization called the Natural Food Associates, which was that led to the establishment of organic standards. But these legacy organic growers that would have tree-ripened pineapples and mangoes, and my parents would identify these people, find them, and would have shipped by railroad and by truck bushels of oranges and apples and pineapples. And the ones we got were the best mangoes, the best pineapples, not the kind that most people are used to. We had the best cashew nuts, the best hazelnuts, the best dried apricots. And they were so good. I mean, they were actually good. And even my friends growing up, they loved coming to my house because we had pineapple like they never ate before. We had cashews like they never ate before. We had mangoes like no people never ate before. So mine were the best avocados, the best fruits and vegetables. So that made it a little easier. And the other component is I had a loving family. I mean, we were really, there's an old TV show in America called Father Knows Best. And it was about this perfect all-American family. Of course, before it wasn't good for Black people, it wasn't good for Hispanic people, but it was a perfect America. But it was a loving family that were there for each other every day. My parents lived, if I was a theater major, they were in eighth row center of every show I was at. They were every performance I was at. We vacationed, we traveled together. We went to theater together. We were a loving family. So we did everything together. And the love that we had of theater, we had of our diet. I trusted what they told me. We enjoyed every aspect of life together. So that helped me stick with it all that time and withstood, I guess, whatever peer pressure was out there in the world. So again, I do think that part of the secret of my success was that we really did have the best fruits and vegetables. When I married my wife, Wanda, 31 years ago, she'd never met a vegan before, never met a vegetarian before, never met a Jewish guy before, never met a liberal Democrat before. But I made the best fruit salads in the world. I had the best, and I think that was a thing that it was a path for her. But boy, being exposed to the best of the best in this lifestyle, I still make the best salads in the world. I make the best fruit salads in the world. I make the best cashew butter in the world. I'm pretty good at that. I could stuff cashew butter in a medjool date. That's a pretty good treat.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Dr. Benish. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. So Dr. Gerald Benish was a contemporary of Dr. Shelton, a little bit younger, but not much. But Dr. Gerald Benish, Dr. William Esser, Dr. Kristen Curcio, Dr. Robert Anderson, Dr. Shelton, they founded the American Natural Hygiene Society. They all operated water fasting clinics, but they all believed in the Sheltonian approach to health and you know, what we call today the whole food plant-based diet. The Sheltonian was whole food. I remember at our old conferences, they our banquets. Oh, it's a little bit different today, but our banquets were a banquet that were mangoes and tomatoes and peppers. They weren't even cut. It's just, you go out with your plate and you take, you know, your leaves of romaine lettuce and you take your peppers and you take an avocado and, you know, maybe you were lucky to get a baked potato, but it was whole foods, bananas and apricots and things like that. So Dr. Benish, everybody's a little unique. You asked me about Dr. Benish, the unique contribution that Dr. Benish made and why he was always one of my heroes is that the exercise was a big component of his. He believed that exercise was just as important to building health. Dr. Shelton also wrote books about it, but you know, he wrote a book, one of his volumes of the hygienic system was called Volume 4 was Exercise. So he was a big proponent of that too. But Dr. Benish in particular, and Dr. Benish was also, again, a guy who I told you, you know, the Benish breakfast was ground up nuts and almonds and sunflowers and the healthy fats. He believed that's how you built strong bones and things like that. So that was kind of his unique contribution to that. And he was my hero for forever because of that.
Looking back on that diet, the diet that you were mentioning, you know, with the cashew butters, the trail mix, the ground almonds and things like that, it's a fairly high fat diet compared to what the whole food plant-based people today would recommend generally a lower fat diet.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a problem of that diet?
I don't. I think, again, you know, for somebody like me growing up on an exclusive raw food diet, I think it was essential. For those that are not and that live more conventional diets, if you experience weight problems, certainly you want to limit your cut. And even, you know, even there, you know, we talked about the disagreement between some of the doctors, even Dr. Furman versus Dr. Esselstyn, even there, the difference is not so great. Dr. Furman will say, you know, you want 2-3 ounces of nuts and seeds every day. 2-3 ounces is not very much. And it's not what most people do. I listened to a great podcast of Dr. McDougall some time ago. He was recalling about how it was when he grew up, and it was around Christmas time, and his dad would bring home a bag of walnuts and filberts and all that kind of stuff, and that's what they'd sit there with their nutcracker and they'd eat them, and it was great. And how many do you think you ate when you had to crack a walnut open and you had to crack a hazelnut open and do that versus today you go to Costco or one of the big box stores and you can buy 5 pounds of shelled cashews.
Yeah.
And you think you just eat kind of like that old Doritos. I'll bet you just can't eat one. And it's the same thing with me, man. When I go to Trader Joe's and I find a bag of cashews, boy, it's real easy to mow them down. And if they're lightly dry roasted and unsalted and they got a little more aroma, same thing with pistachios, boy, it's easy to scarf them down. So you can have problems doing that. And certainly, you know, cashew butter and those things are even more concentrated. And when they're roasted, there's even more, you know, problematic. It's even more concentrated and more natural oils and fat get into it. So for people to grow up like me, I don't think it's an issue. I don't think I can get too much. I suppose I could get too much fat, but I eat plenty of cashews. I probably eat 2 avocados a day, and it hasn't contributed any weight problems. I wish it would sometimes, but it hasn't. And I really enjoy nuts and dates and seeds, but I think the better wisdom is for most people that don't live on an exclusively or primarily a raw food diet, that you need to watch your, you know, the fat intake that you can get from that. But clearly there is a difference that Brenda Davis and others will say between the healthy fats that are combined with, you know, Colin Campbell said one time kind of famously that, you know, we know what the nutritional content of an almond is, but only God has made an almond. And it's combined with all the other nutrient and digestible factors that the way we're supposed to eat them. They're made for human consumption. It's a little different, and of course, again, you know, you get caught up in the, and you look at a lot of these studies about nuts and the studies that are done. I question how many are done of people consuming nuts of raw cashews versus roasted and oiled cashews. I think you just got to be careful. But for me, I don't believe that, coming back to your point, I don't believe that if you're an exclusively, everybody's a little different, but I think if you're exclusively primarily whole foods in your diet, you don't have a weight problem, I don't think your healthy fats are going to be a problem. Most people are not like me. Most people do not eat exclusively whole foods in their diet. And for them, they need to watch. Same thing with dried fruits. You know, it's concentrated sugar. You know, these dried fruits are more concentrated. So you want to be, you want to be careful how much sugar you're consuming when you do that. Just, you worry about the protein and the fat content of nuts. You worry about the sugar content of dried foods. I don't worry about it personally, just because I have a body of life to kind of measure it against. But it also just sort of makes sense that it's just not an issue. One of the things I find rewarding, there is a philosophic side to this, to me, that fortunately, kind of makes sense that, this is better for this diet is better for our physiology. It's better for the planet. It's better for the critters. Healthy plants develop healthy soil. There's healthy people. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a regenerative organic farmer, but it makes sense. It just makes sense. And that's the beauty of this diet and lifestyle. Look, can I read you a quote? My favorite quote of all time.
Sure.
There is, I can put my hand on it. One of the leading voices, one of the original natural hygienists, Dr. Russell Thacker Trawl, had a quotation that I've always been famous for. Dr. Trawl is the guy who's most famous for delivering a lecture to the Smithsonian Institute called The True Healing Art. If you Google it, he was really making the clarion call for a different way of looking at medicine. And Dr. Trawl ran a big clinic in Connecticut or New York or something like that. But he was a prolific writer like Dr. Shelton, but just one of the guys Dr. Shelton based his stuff on. And Dr. Trawl lived from 1812 to 1877. And he wrote, "The system which we endorse and practice is true, in harmony with nature, in accordance with the laws of the vital organism, correct in science, sound in philosophy, in agreement with common sense, successful in results, and a blessing to mankind." That is this lifestyle. I think it is all of those things. It's better for the environment. It's better for the planet. It happens to make sense. It's in harmony with nature. That's why we do what we do. And it's kind of the philosophic underpinnings of my life. Right. I think it is right for all the right reasons. What I think.
Sure. So let's go to the organization that you run and the magazine. I'd like to talk to you more about those things.
Sure.
And it goes back that you've already mentioned about the history of the Natural Health Association. I think you were saying that it came from the Natural Hygiene Association, which was started by those doctors that had the various clinics. And it's obviously continued to this day. And you've been the president of it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the history of it and your involvement?
Sure. I think, as you mentioned earlier, we are the oldest organization on the planet advocating the benefits of a whole food plant-based diet, which, again, was originally the natural hygiene diet. It's what is called today. And we don't even use, I think we kind of shy away from the term plant-based. You know, even T. Colin Campbell, who invented the term whole food plant-based for a scientific paper, just needed something to distinguish a vegetarian diet from a vegan diet. But even he agreed it was not a perfect definition, because plant-based, potato chips are plant-based. Marijuana is plant-based. Beer is plant-based. This doesn't necessarily mean health. And unfortunately, so much of the vegan world is unmeat, and maybe undairy in most cases, but not particularly healthy because of salt, oil, sugar, and all the other preservatives. So, but the natural hygiene diet, the whole plant food diet and lifestyle that we continue to trumpet for all of our 74 years, has been pretty consistent. And so we as an organization, we're a 501c3, which in the United States means we're that you make donations to the NHA. We're an education organization. Your donations are tax deductible. We're nonprofit, but we're also tax exempt. So if in the United States, you get a tax benefit, it's a special status that you can enjoy. And we've had that status since the 60s. And so we continue to trumpet what we consider this gold standard of a whole plant food diet and lifestyle without adding oil, salt, and sugar, recognize the importance of rest and exercise and emotional poise and taking care of our planet. Those are all components of health. So we do that. We hold our annual health conferences where, you know, the greatest of the greatest continue, I think some of the greatest voices of our movement continue to come together and lecture. Dr. Furman, who grew up in this business, in this movement like I did, Dr. Goldhammer, the same, Dr. Frank Sabatino, the same, they've grown up over the years, Dr. Sidwalk from the UK, Dr. Burton from Australia, and other doctors around the United States come. And every year, as we have grown and as the lifestyle medicine movement has kind of exploded in this country, we always bring in other, you know, other stars of the movement, you know, Neil Bernard and Michael Clapper. This year we have Dr. Columbus Batiste, a cardiologist from Kaiser, Brenda Davis from Vancouver, British Columbia, the renowned registered dietitian. So we bring these voices together to, you know, kind of bring the latest science that validates this diet and also help. And people gather, I think, as much to be educated as to have their batteries recharged, to kind of reaffirm and to be around like-minded people. You know, for so many people, even couples, it's often a one-person band. You know, wife might follow this lifestyle, but the husband doesn't. And it's difficult, it's lonely. And so when you come together for our conferences and you have 350 people all eating together, dining together, hanging out together, exercising, going to an exercise class, going on a hike together, that's really reaffirming. It kind of makes you part of a community. So that's part of the space in this health movement that we occupy, holding these annual conferences, being that, providing that sense of community for people. And as I mentioned earlier, we publish, you know, Health Science Magazine, that is a 40-page magazine that I mentioned is really unique because it has no advertising in it. Just, I do an interview in every issue with one of the stars of our health movement. This Dean Ornish was the last one. It was just a great interview. There are recipes, but it's not a recipe magazine. There's, you know, each we feature an SOS-free recipe chef in each issue. And we have testimonials, we have feature articles, all just educational. It's people tell us, what I'm really proud of as the editor is it's the one magazine people get that they read cover to cover because it's just unique. It's not, you go into any health food store and most of the health magazines you pick up are one of two things. They're either recipes or they're advertisements for the latest tofu or latest soy sauce or the latest whatever you can call or latest vitamin pills or potions or protein supplements or whatever they are. That's not what we are.
Yeah.
That's not what we do. And then we've added a few other things. We're taking advantage more of social media. So we have our own once a month, a free thing called Power Your Health Q&A, where I interview one of our doctors. You can live post your questions to them. Could just sign up on our website, post your questions, interact live. We're about to start another podcast, the Health Science Podcast with Dr. Frank Sabatino. So, and then for our conference this year, as I may have mentioned earlier, if you can't attend in person, we offer a live stream option for the conference for, I think, until May 21st for $97, wherever you are in the world. You can live stream all of the events of the conference. Obviously, you can't eat online, but we'll take you through the line. We'll see the meals that we prepare. You'll talk to the chefs. You'll We'll do a lot of backstage stuff. So we try to make it really interactive. And then when you, if you purchase the live stream, you also have the option, you'll have the access to all of the replays of the lectures for up to a year. We have a Vimeo account, and it's just like going to YouTube. You'll be able to log in with a username and password and share those videos, you know, watch them as often as you want, share them with your friends. So that's the educational work that we do as an organization. And we've been doing that. And we are, you'll see on the inside back cover of every issue, we always post the names of all of the people that have joined the organization just since the last issue. And we're, because of social media, what was maybe a kind of a best kept secret for a long time as an organization, even though we've been around a long time, we're not such a secret anymore. And so people are finding us, and they're joining for their $35 or the $55 if you live outside the US, and supporting the cause. So that's pretty rewarding, and we're experiencing some wonderful growth because of social media.
Do you think that that there's something special about or essential about, because there is a lot of stuff online now, there's more evidence, there's information, there's a lot of people sharing videos and recipes and pictures, and there's tremendous amounts of stuff being published every day around this lifestyle. But do you think there's still something essential about having these gatherings, as you were saying?
I think COVID was really an unfortunate state of affairs. In the United States, there was we were growing every year. We were, the size of our conferences were growing until COVID, and then we couldn't hold them. We weren't allowed, you couldn't do it. Last year we had one, we had, I think, close to 300 people, and you know, we'll be on track. We'll probably be increasing that. There's an organization called the Plantrician Project that was formed, a group of lifestyle medicine physicians formed by Dr. Scott Stoll. Their first conference had 400, then 700, then 800, then 1,100, and then COVID.
Yeah.
And had to do it virtually. It's not the same. It's not the same experience. Certainly, you know, the advantages of people being comfortable with Zoom allows you and me to get together and to share that we never could have done before. And now even seniors are comfortable using this medium, which is a great thing, but it's no substitute. It's not a substitute, I don't think, for coming together as a community. There is something really reaffirming about being around like-minded people, sharing meals together. You know, if you're in this lifestyle, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm sure you don't get it. You probably have a couple of close personal friends, but you probably don't get invited to dinner often. Nor do you invite people over for dinner often, other than those close personal friends. Just because meals are, you know, it's just such a social thing. Even our family, I mean, we come together for Thanksgiving and Christmas and Passover and things like that, but we bring our own stuff just because it's not. So the idea to be able to come together as we do at our conferences is pretty special. The other thing that's pretty special is that, you know, Dr. Furman, some of these real stars of the movement, this is like their home too. It's like coming home. So Dr. Goldhammer, Dr. Furman, Dr. Sabatino, there, you're eating lunch with them. They don't just come give a lecture and they leave, like so many other conferences I think do, where they pay them big fees to attend. They come. They come because it's part of their movement. But it's also very special for the people that attend. To be sitting at lunch with Dr. Furman is pretty good. I feel pretty good. Personally, I feel pretty good. When I see him on public television, I'm pretty proud of seeing that. But it's affirming, and so I think that sense of community is really important, and is these are adjuncts, but I don't think they're substitutes for what Zoom is. But you know what? When Forks Over Knives came out, and What the Health, and some of these tremendous documentaries, I mean, they're still wildly popular on YouTube. They've had an impact that people growing up in the Natural Hygiene Society that I grew up couldn't have dreamed of, the outreach and the impact that those things could have.
Sure.
But, you know, that's kind of how I look at it.
Absolutely. What the plant-based movement as it is today, it seems to be growing rapidly. It seems like veganism is growing rapidly. It's really having an impact. You've got the plant-based meats now. The phrase plant-based, you can find that virtually everywhere now, almost every, even small towns, you know, small restaurants or whatever, often will have a vegan option now, will have plant-based options. And do you think that the natural hygiene movement has played a major role in that all happening? Is that kind of one of the major important elements of
that? I don't know. And I have mixed feelings about a lot of this. Right. To this day, when you go to a vegan restaurant, if you're from, you know, a whole food plant-based guy, there isn't often a lot for me to eat. I like salads. You know, when you go back to the core of your this is a fruit and vegetable podcast thing. Like, I mean, I'm a fruit and vegetable guy, and you're hard pressed to find a salad. That's why I love salad bars. I mean, let me just have a salad and I'm great. But unfortunately, most vegan restaurants have become vegan chic. So you'll get, you know, pâtés and vegan cheeses and vegan burritos and vegan all these things. But to me, and there's often not a lot of attention paid to salt, oil, and sugar. So right. it's almost vegan junk food. And when you get to the plant-based meats, the Impossible Burger, you know, it is a mixed, I have mixed feelings about it, because number one, yes, is it better for the planet if we would transition to, you know, to all of the environmental problems that go with raising cattle and sheep and chickens and things like that? Yeah, I guess it's a good thing. But from a health standpoint, most of these things are high in salt, high in sugar. There's not a lot of whole food about it. So is it better for the planet? Is it better for the critters? I guess it is. But is it a step forward nutritionally? I'm not so sure. I'm not so convinced of that. And then, you know, there's the other dimension of the, within the vegan movement, of the free range chickens and the grass fed beef. At the end of the day, there's a lot of argument. First of all, that industry has become kind of bastardized. The standards that allow for, in the United States in particular, that what is classified as cage-free eggs or grass-fed beef are not a whole lot better than some of the conventional big ag has gotten involved. And that's really bastardized the business here a lot. There's not Dean Dairy, took over a lot of Horizon and some of these big brands in the United States. And there's, I don't know if you've heard of something called the Real Organic Project. Followed by a guy named Paul Chapman. And there's some guys that are real pioneers in the movement have been trying to reclaim the movement, because in the United States, hydroponics, growing blueberries and tomatoes and all these in pots and with drips, are classified as organic. And that was never what the organic movement was supposed to be about. It was all supposed to be about the soil and the soil biome. You can't get all the blueberries and raspberries and strawberries that look so beautiful that are certified organic. Fortunately, in the UK and the European Union, you can't do that. In the United States, you can. And so it's unfortunate. So getting back to your point about is it a net positive? I suppose the Impossible Burger and things are net positives, but I don't get too enthusiastic about it, because I think they're a poor substitute for a whole food plant-based diet. It's just another... It's another processed food, which is contradictory to this. You know, I'm not, even though I didn't grow up with, you know, bean burgers and grain burgers and things like that, I understand, you know, having lentil burgers and things like that. This is good, because these are made out of whole foods. When you get to the Impossible Burgers and these kind of things, there's nothing particularly helpful about it. Is it better for the planet if we would transition to that? Am I glad that McDonald's is offering the option? But I think they're offering the option for marketing and financial reasons rather than for any real ethical values on their part of trying to do something for the world.
So how do you think, what do you think is the best way for us to try and get this information out there to other people and maybe to try and build community and friendships and things like that with others doing this and share this. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think becoming a member of our organization is one way to stay connected with a community that has consistent standards. And again, even though we set out the gold standard, we understand not everybody's on the path, not everybody's going to become whole food, whole plant-based, whole plant food diet and lifestyle without added oil, salt, and sugar. They're not going to become that 100%, but they know what the standard is. And you know, the when you get in a health crisis, you need to be a little more careful than you would. If you got a better constitution, you got a little more flexibility. So I think you do that, you get our magazine. You know, there are Rip Esselstyn runs they have something called Plant Stock, where they offer, you know, retreats, kind of like we do at our conference, but theirs are more lifestyle. They're out in the mountains and the hills, but the food is right, the people, those are things to go. Dr. McDougall used to offer these kind of travel things, travel opportunities, but they don't do that now. We in the NHA offer a new thing that we did, we started a couple of years ago, is NHA travel, where we kind of don't commandeer the whole ship, but we get a good portion of it. And we take care, we ensure that the meals that you'll get are vegan SOS free. And so we did one, our first one was at the River Cruise up the Rhine River in 2019, right before COVID. And then COVID, you know, you couldn't travel. Now we just did our first one in the Baja in Mexico, where people could go, and my wife did all the meals, and it was a wonderful trip. And we have one coming up in Alaska in August, and another one in the Galapagos in February 2023. So you can get those opportunities. And again, coming back to what we said earlier about that sense of community that you can get when you participate. There's also some great bloggers around too that I'm really proud of, as two members of our board. Is there's a Brittany Giroudi, the Giroudi family website. If you Google them on YouTube, she's a great YouTuber, has probably 70 to 100,000 followers. They're all her recipes are SOS free, and she's just a great personality. Dylan Holmes of Well Your World. These are members there. These are all, again, gold standard of this kind of cooking, but make it delightful and make it fun. And they're building a great social media following. They're us. And they can be you if you become a member of this community. So that's the best thing I get. Again, the wonderful thing is that through the internet, there are so many great resources available now that there never were before. It's just a great way to get reinforced.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, Seymour. Sure. I'm sure that there's so much more to talk about, but
so where are you based in the UK? Where are you?
I'm based in Glasgow, Scotland.
Oh, in Scotland. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to try and come over, though. I've been in
You know, up until now you couldn't travel. And it's been I like to travel. I've been to Israel, I've been to Greece, I've been everywhere. Yeah. And it's on the bucket list to do that. And we were actually, Dr. Furman had a retreat that he was doing every year, every other year in Puglia, Italy. And we were going to go to Dublin because it was cheaper to go from New York to Dublin and Dublin to Puglia than it was this to Puglia. And so Ireland and Scotland were the Emerald Isle was certainly on the bucket list. So we have an NHA member in Dublin who's a doctor who runs a very progressive clinic. And I have an open invitation to visit him. So sounds like I have another open invitation to Scotland.
Absolutely, for sure. If you ever want to come over, for sure we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
but it's great, and I'm sure that I'd love to speak to you again another time. Maybe we can go into more detail about some of the stuff that we've been talking about. We didn't get to talk a lot about you actually, and maybe we should finish off with a bit more about your role, what are your goals, and what you're doing. What are your activities on a general basis with the magazine and everything? What does that all look like?
So I like to consider myself kind of modeled after my father. I'm kind of a public citizen guy. I'm kind of a man for all seasons. So, most people that would think about me think I live this extreme diet, or certainly live this extreme diet, but I'm not extreme or unique in any other way. I love sports. I'm involved with politics. I'm involved with civil rights. I'm involved in our community. I've been a leader of our community playhouse. I've been in our legal aid society. I'm right now, I'm the administrator of a magistrates association that does continuing education for judicial magistrates. I'm a mediator for our local probate court. I was a lawyer for, you know, for 40 years and a family court judge. So my father, my late great father, Max, was a fan of his hero, was the guy by the name of Horace Mann, who is considered the father of public education in the United States. He has a statue on Boston Commons in Boston, Massachusetts. And Horace Mann had a quote that said, "Be ashamed to die until you've won some victories for humanity." So that's kind of the model that he brought my brother and I up. I have an older brother who's dean at Bradley University. And we both have been involved in the community, trying to make a difference, trying to make the world a better place. And so whether it's the organic food movement or obviously the lifestyle proposed by the National Health Association, but I also am a big champion of the arts and public education and things like that. That's what makes me tick. And kind of like I've often said that Dr. Furman wrote a book called Eat to Live. And it was a play on the words, you know, most of America lives to eat. I eat to live. The food that I eat, the lifestyle has enabled me to live life to the fullest. I love to travel. I love to see the world. I love to discover different kinds of people and different kinds of culture. So that's what continues to make Mark Huberman tick. And maybe most of all is that my wife and I have our first grandchild, and that's as good as it gets of being able to do that is quite a privilege. So that's the broader picture of Mark Huberman. Yeah, I'm the president of National Health Association. I champion whole food plant-based diet, but I love sports. I love basketball and football, professional sports and life and politics and all that. I'm engaged with life on lots of levels.
Fantastic. That's a great message, I think, to bring us to an end. And if people want to contact you or get involved, where should they go?
Sure, go to healthscience.org. And by the way, just as a kind of a benefit to your viewers and your is that I believe that people should be able to look before they leap. And if they email me at mhuberman@healthscience.org, I will email them an electronic copy of the latest issue of Health Science magazine. They can look at it. They like what they see, and they want to register on our website. They can do that, and if they not, they'll just their horizons will be broadened by seeing the quality of the publication that we got. But I'll do that for free. Anybody that just emails me at mhuberman@healthscience.org. Healthscience.org is our URL. It happens to be also our email address. Check out our website. There's a lot of free stuff right on our website. Again, when you join, you can get all 44 years of back issues of the magazine. And if you're a fan of the history of the health movement that we talked about here, the natural hygiene movement, one of the things that is really unique is that before Health Science magazine, there was a little publication called Natural Hygiene and the Journal of Natural Hygiene. And I've digitized all of those. And there you can look at those for free and read articles by Dr. Shelton, Dr. Benish, and Dr. Esser that were really timeless in their teachings many years ago. And there's even Dr. Shelton wrote his books, The Hygienic System, in the 30s, way ahead of his time. And we've even, one of the first things I did when I became president here is I digitized those books. They're old, they're out of print, they're kind of dated, but they were way ahead of their time. And you can download those for free, whether you have an ebook or a tablet, whatever format you need. Again, free, part of your membership. It's just a free benefit for that $35 or $55. So take a look at the website, and I think you'll find, again, kind of that we're unique as an organization. We're not selling anything. We're not going to upsell you, you know, a 50 DVD or CD set. You're going to get a magazine. You're going to get information. You're going to have access to our podcasts, our legacy, our history. That's what we offer.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. And I encourage everyone to check that out. And thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. Please feel free to share this with others and pass it on. And you can check out our own festivals and events and things that we're doing in the UK at fruitfest.co.uk. And thank you very much for watching. And
by the way, before we leave, can I give you one? When I was at Dr. Furman, since this is Fruit Fest and you're very interested in fruits and vegetables, I'm always interested in unique fruits and vegetables that I, and every once in a while, I think I've tried everything and I come across one. So at Dr. Furman's, he has probably 150 fruit trees at this beautiful retreat he has in the hills of San Diego. And one of them is a, let me just cut this off. One of them is a Pakistani mulberry tree. You ever heard of a Pakistani mulberry tree? No. They are mulberries that are long and thin, rather than mulberries are kind of rounded and kind of square, and they tend to be sour. These are one of the sweetest things you'll ever eat in your life, and they grow in kind of like climates like that. And there's another fruit that he has called a sapote, which is, there's a green sapote. It's like a, they call them a custard apple, because there you cut them open, there's a couple of big white seeds in the middle, but it's mostly this flesh that literally tastes like you're eating custard. And I thought I'd known everything, but try a Pakistani mulberry if you can come across one, and a green sapote. There's also a chocolate one, but I like the green ones, the green sapotes that that you'll find. I'm a fan of great mangoes and fruits and vegetables and fresh figs and things like that. So, but that's my cultural tip of the day.
I have one last question that came to mind, actually. You've had the conference going, you've seen everyone, you've met everyone. Who can you give us a standout speech, or who do you think was like the best speaker, the best moment in terms of in terms of like a speaker, an orator?
Well, I think the best within our movement, the best, most charismatic speaker today is one of the youngest, is Dr. Stefan Esser. He's an MD who's the grandson of William Esser, one of our founders. Apples don't fall far from trees, but Stefan is one of the most gifted presenters I have ever been at. I mean, if you're off stage and you're asking him a question, he tunes into you. I mean, almost like a preacher. He's gifted. He's a gifted presenter. He really does well. And the other within the lifestyle medicine guy, there's probably nobody better than Michael Greger. Michael Greger is a show. He's just entertaining. He's got a unique style about him. Certainly Dr. Furman is interesting. Certainly Dr. I mean, we have a lot of great exponents right now, but I guess if I had to say, Stefan Esser is one of the most charismatic that I've met. And Michael Greger is one of the most entertaining. He's just a gas to be around, because he's a little rickety and hickety. And he's just a gifted presenter. So those are two favorites that I have. But, you know, I just interviewed Dean Ornish for the latest issue of the magazine. And I've been doing these interviews for probably, I don't know, 10 years, something like that. And Dean Ornish was one of the most enjoyable people I've ever interviewed in my life. He's just thoughtful and interesting and all that. And if you read his interview, you'll learn things about him that you probably never knew. Everybody probably knows about his heart reversal program, but who is Dean Ornish? That's what I got to bring out in the interview. So those are two of my favorites.
Excellent. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Mark. And thanks everyone for watching and listening. We'll see you in another episode of the Love Fruit Podcast.
Right.